of America's youth take the bait? We'd have to see. As the first group settled into their seats, we explained the rules and handed out the tests. They worked for their 15 minutes, then copied their answers onto the bubble sheet, and turned in their worksheets and bubble sheets. These students were our control group. Since they hadn't been given any of the answers, they had no opportunity at all to cheat. On average, they got 32.6 of the 50 questions right. What do you predict that the participants in our other experimental conditions did? Given that the participants in the control condition solved, on average, 32.6 questions correctly, how many questions do you think the participants in the other three conditions claimed to have solved correctly? Condition 1, control, equals 32.6. Condition 2, self-check, equals... Condition 3, self-check plus shredding, equals... Condition 4, self-check plus shredding plus money jar, equals... What about the second group? They too answered the questions, but this time, when they transferred their answers to the bubble sheet, they could see the correct answers. Would they sweep their integrity under the rug for an extra 10 cents per question? As it turned out, this group claimed to have solved, on average, 36.2 questions. Were they smarter than our control group? Doubtful. Instead, we caught them in a bit of cheating, by about 3.6 questions. What about the third group? This time we upped the ante. They not only got to see the correct answers, but were also asked to shred their worksheets. Did they take the bait? Yes, they cheated. On average, they claimed to have solved 35.9 questions correctly, more than the participants in the control condition, but about the same as the participants in the second group, the group that did not shred their worksheets. Finally came the students who were told to shred not only their worksheets, but the bubble sheets as well, and then dip their hands into the money jar and withdraw whatever they deserved. Like angels, they shredded their worksheets, stuck their hands into the money jar, and withdrew their coins. The problem was that these angels had dirty faces. Their claims added up to an average 36.1 correct answers, quite a bit higher than the 32.6 of our control group, but basically the same as the other two groups who had the opportunity to cheat. What did we learn from this experiment? The first conclusion is that when given the opportunity, many honest people will cheat. In fact, rather than finding that a few bad apples weighted the averages, we discovered that the majority of people cheated, and that they cheated just a little bit. The distribution of the number of correctly solved questions remained the same across all four conditions, but with a mean shift when the participants could cheat. And before you blame the refined air at the Harvard Business School for this level of dishonesty, I should add that we conducted similar experiments at MIT, Princeton, UCLA, and Yale, with similar results. The second, and more counterintuitive result, was even more impressive. Once tempted to cheat, the participants didn't seem to be as influenced by the risk of being caught as one might think. When the students were given the opportunity to cheat without being able to shred their papers, they increased their correct answers from 32.6 to 36.2. But when they were offered the chance to shred their papers, hiding their little crime completely, they didn't push their dishonesty farther. They still cheated at about the same level. This means that even when we have no chance of getting caught, we still don't become wildly dishonest. When the students could shred both their papers, dip their hand into the money jar, and walk away, every one of them could have claimed a perfect test score, or could have taken more money. The jar had about $100 in it. But none of them did. Why? Something held them back. Something inside them. But what was it? What is honesty, anyhow? To that question, Adam Smith, the great economic thinker, had a pleasant reply. Nature, when she formed man for society, endowed him with an original desire to please, and an original aversion to offend his brethren. She taught him to feel pleasure in their favourable, and pain in their unfavourable, regard, he noted. To this, Smith added, the success of most people almost always depends upon the favour and good opinion of their neighbours and equals, and without a tolerably regular conduct, These can very seldom be obtained. The good old proverb, therefore, that honesty is always the best policy, holds, in such situations, almost always perfectly true. That sounds like a plausible industrial age explanation, as balanced and harmonious as a set of balance weights and perfectly meshed gears. However optimistic this perspective might seem, Smith's theory had a darker corollary. Since people engage in a cost-benefit analysis with regard to honesty, they can also engage in a cost-benefit analysis to be dishonest. According to this perspective, individuals are honest only to the extent that suits them, including their desire to please others. Are decisions about honesty and dishonesty based on the same cost-benefit analysis that we use to decide between cars, cheeses, and computers? I don't think so. First of all, can you imagine a friend explaining to you the cost-benefit analysis that went into buying his new laptop? Of course. But can you imagine your friend sharing with you a cost-benefit analysis of his decision to steal a laptop? Of course not. Not unless your friend is a professional thief. Rather, I agree with others, from Plato down, who say that honesty is something bigger. Something that is considered a moral virtue in nearly every society. Sigmund Freud explained it this way. He said that as we grow up in society, we internalize the social virtues. This internalization leads to the development of the superego. In general, the superego is pleased when we comply with society's ethics, and unhappy when we don't. This is why we stop our car at 4 a.m. when we see a red light, even if we know that no one is around. And it is why we get a warm feeling when we return a lost wallet to its owner, even if our identity is never revealed. Such acts stimulate the reward centers of our brain, the nucleus accumbens and the caudate nucleus, and make us content. But if honesty is important to us, in a recent survey of nearly 36,000 high school students in the United States, 98% of them said it was important to be honest. And if honesty makes us feel good, why are we so frequently dishonest? This is my take. We care about honesty, and we want to be honest. The problem is that our internal honesty monitor is active only when we contemplate big transgressions, like grabbing an entire box of pens from the conference hall. For the little transgressions, like taking a single pen or two pens, we don't even consider how these actions would reflect on our honesty, and so our superego stays asleep. Without the superego's help, monitoring and managing of our honesty, the only defense we have against this kind of transgression is a rational cost-benefit analysis. But who is going to consciously weigh the benefits of taking a towel from a hotel room versus the cost of being caught? Who is going to consider the costs and benefits of adding a few receipts to a tax statement? As we saw in the experiment at Harvard, the cost-benefit analysis, and the probability of getting caught in particular, does not seem to have much influence on dishonesty. This is the way the world turns. It's almost impossible to open a newspaper without seeing a report of a dishonest or deceptive act. We watch as the credit card companies bleed their customers with outrageous interest rate hikes, as the airlines plunge into bankruptcy and then call on the federal government to get them and their underfunded pension funds out of trouble, and as schools defend the presence of soda machines on campus and rake in millions from the soft drinks firms, all the while knowing that sugary drinks make kids hyperactive and fat. Taxes are a festival of eroding ethics, as the insightful and talented reporter David K. Johnston of the New York Times describes in his book, Perfectly Legal, the Covert Campaign to Rig Our Tax System to Benefit the Super Rich and Cheat Everybody Else. Against all of this, society, in the form of the government, has battled back, at least to some extent. The Sarbanes-Oxley Act of 2002, which requires the chief executives of public companies to vouch for the firm's audits and accounts, was passed to make debacles, like Enron's, a thing of the past. Congress has also passed restrictions on earmarking, specifically the pork barrel spending that politicians insert into larger federal bills. The Securities and Exchange Commission even passed requirements for additional disclosure about executives' pay and perks, so that when we see a stretched limo carrying a Fortune 500 executive, we know pretty certainly how much the corporate chief inside is getting paid. But can external measures like these really plug all the holes and prevent dishonesty? Some critics say they can't. Take the ethics reforms in Congress, for instance. The statutes ban lobbyists from serving free meals to congressmen and their aides at widely attended functions. So what have lobbyists done? Invited congressmen to luncheons with limited guest lists that circumvent the rule. Similarly, the new ethics laws ban lobbyists from flying congressmen in fixed-wing aircraft. So hey, how about a lift in a helicopter? The most amusing new law I've heard about is called the toothpick rule. It states that although lobbyists can no longer provide sit-down meals to congressmen, the lobbyists can still serve anything, presumably hors d'oeuvres, which the legislators can eat while standing up and plop into their mouths using their fingers or a toothpick. Did this change the plans of the seafood industry, which had organized a sit-down pasta and oyster dinner for Washington's legislators, called, you guessed it, Let the World Be Your Oyster? Not by much. The seafood lobbyists did drop the pasta dish, too messy to fork up with a toothpick, but still fed the congressman well with freshly opened raw oysters, which the congressman slurped down standing up. Sarbanes-Oxley has also been called ineffectual. Some critics say that it's rigid and inflexible, but the loudest outcry is from those who call it ambiguous, inconsistent, inefficient, and outrageously expensive, especially for smaller firms. It hasn't cleaned up corruption, argued William A. Niskanen, chairman of the Cato Institute. It has only forced companies to jump through hoops. So much for enforcing honesty through external controls. They may work in some cases, but not in others. Could there be a better cure for dishonesty? Before I even attempt to answer that question, let me describe an experiment we conducted that speaks volumes on the subject. A few years ago, Nina, On, and I brought a group of participants together in a lab at UCLA and asked them to take a simple math test. The test consisted of 20 simple problems. Each problem was based on 12 numbers, such as 2.36, 4.97, or 7.63. The participants then had to find the two numbers among the 12 that added up to 10. They had 5 minutes to solve as many of the problems as they could, after which they were entered into a lottery. If they won the lottery, they would receive $10 for each problem they solved correctly. As in our experiment at the Harvard Business School, some of the participants handed in their papers directly to the experimenter. They were our control group. The other participants wrote down on another sheet the number of questions they solved correctly and then disposed of the originals. These participants, obviously, were the ones with the opportunity to cheat. So given this opportunity, did these participants cheat? As you may have surmised, they did. But of course, just by a bit. Up to now, I have not told you anything new. But the key to this experiment was what preceded it. When the participants first came to the lab, we asked some of them to write down the names of 10 books that they read in high school. The others were asked to write down as many of the 10 commandments as they could recall. Do you know the 10 commandments? If you'd like to test yourself, write them down and compare your list with the list at the end of this chapter. To be sure you have them right, don't just say them to yourself. Write them down. After they finished this memory part of the experiment, we asked them to begin working on the matrix task. This experimental setup meant that some of the participants were tempted to cheat after recalling 10 books that they read in high school, and some of them were tempted after recalling the 10 commandments. Who do you think cheated more? When cheating was not possible, our participants, on average, solved 3.1 problems correctly. Can the 10 commandments raise one's math scores? We used the same 2 memory tasks with the control condition to test that premise. The performance in this control condition was the same regardless of the type of memory task. So the commandments do not raise math scores. When cheating was possible, the group that recalled 10 books read in high school achieved an average score of 4.1 questions solved, or 33% more than those who could not cheat. But the big question is what happened to the other group? The students who first wrote down the Ten Commandments, took the test, and then ripped up their worksheets. This, as sportscasters say, was the group to watch. Would they cheat? Or would the Ten Commandments have an effect on their integrity? The result surprised even us. The students, who had been asked to recall the Ten Commandments, had not cheated at all. They averaged 3 correct answers, the same basic score as the group that could not cheat, and 1 less than those who were able to cheat, but had recalled the names of the books. As I walked home that evening, I began to think about what had just happened. The group who listed 10 books cheated. Not a lot, certainly. Only to that point where their internal reward mechanism, nucleus accumbens and superego, kicked in and rewarded them for stopping. But what a miracle the 10 commandments had wrought. We didn't even remind our participants what the commandments were. We just asked each participant to recall them, and almost none of the participants could recall all 10. We hoped the exercise might evoke the idea of honesty among them, and this was clearly what it did. So, we wondered, what lessons can we learn from this experiment for decreasing dishonesty? It took us a few weeks to come to some conclusions. For one, perhaps we could bring the Bible back into public life. If we only want to reduce dishonesty, it might not be a bad idea. Then again, some people might object, on the grounds that the Bible implies an endorsement of a particular religion, or merely that it mixes religion with the commercial and secular world. But perhaps an oath of a different nature would work. What especially impressed me about the experiment with the 10 commandments was that the students who could remember only 1 or 2 commandments were as affected by them as the students who remembered nearly all 10. This indicated that it was not the commandments themselves that encouraged honesty, but the mere contemplation of a moral benchmark of some kind. If that were the case, then we could also use non-religious benchmarks to raise the general level of honesty. For instance, what about the professional oaths that doctors, lawyers, and others swear to, or used to swear to? Could those professional oaths do the trick? The word profession comes from the Latin professus, meaning affirmed publicly. Professions started somewhere deep in the past in religion, and then spread to medicine and law. Individuals who had mastered esoteric knowledge, it was said, not only had a monopoly on the practice of that knowledge, but had an obligation to use their power wisely and honestly. The oath, spoken and often written, was a reminder to practitioners to regulate their own behavior, and it also provided a set of rules that had to be followed in fulfilling the duties of their profession. These oaths lasted a long time. But then in the 1960s, a strong movement arose to deregulate professions. Professions were elitist organizations, it was argued, and needed to be turned out into the light of day. For the legal profession, that meant more briefs written in plain English prose, cameras in the courtrooms, and advertising. Similar measures against elitism were applied to medicine, banking, and other professions as well. Much of this could have been beneficial, but something was lost when professions were dismantled. Strict professionalism was replaced by flexibility, individual judgment, the laws of commerce, and the urge for wealth, and with it disappeared the bedrock of ethics and values on which the professions had been built. A study by the State Bar of California in the 1990s, for instance, found that a preponderance of attorneys in California were sick of the decline in honor in their work and profoundly pessimistic about the condition of the legal profession. 2/3 said that lawyers today compromise their professionalism as a result of economic pressure. Nearly 80% said that the bar fails to adequately punish unethical attorneys. Half said they wouldn't become attorneys if they had it to do over again. A comparable study by the Maryland Judicial Task Force found similar distress among lawyers in that state. According to Maryland's lawyers, their profession had degenerated so badly that they were often irritable, short-tempered, argumentative, and verbally abusive, or detached, withdrawn, preoccupied, or distracted. When lawyers in Virginia were asked whether the increasing problems with professionalism were attributable to a few bad apples or to a widespread trend, They overwhelmingly said this was a widespread issue. Lawyers in Florida have been deemed the worst. In 2003, the Florida Bar reported that a substantial minority of lawyers were money-grabbing, too clever, tricky, sneaky, and not trustworthy, who had little regard for the truth or fairness, willing to distort, manipulate, and conceal to win, arrogant, condescending, and abusive. They were also pompous and obnoxious. What more can I say? The medical profession has its critics as well. The critics mention doctors who do unnecessary surgeries and other procedures just to boost the bottom line, who order tests at laboratories that are giving them kickbacks, and who lean toward medical tests on equipment that they just happen to own. And what about the influence of the pharmaceutical industry? A friend of mine said he sat waiting for his doctor for an hour recently. During that time, he said, four very attractive representatives of drug companies went freely into and out of the office, bringing lunch, free samples, and other gifts with them. You could look at almost any professional group and see signs of similar problems. How about the Association of Petroleum Geologists, for instance? The image I see is Indiana Jones types, with more interest in discussing Jurassic shale and deltaic deposits than in making a buck. But look deeper, and you'll find trouble. There is unethical behavior going on at a much larger scale than most of us would care to think, one member of the association wrote to her colleagues. What kind of dishonesty, for goodness sake, could be rife in the ranks of petroleum geologists, you ask? Apparently, things like using bootlegged seismic and digital data, stealing maps and materials, and exaggerating the promise of certain oil deposits in cases where a land sale or investment is being made. The malfeasance is most frequently of shades of grey, rather than black and white, one petroleum geologist remarked. But let's remember that petroleum geologists are not alone. This decline in professionalism is everywhere. If you need more proof, consider the debate within the field of professional ethicists, who are called more often than ever before to testify at public hearings and trials, where they may be hired by one party or another to consider issues such as treatment rendered to a patient and the rights of the unborn. Are they tempted to bend to the occasion? Apparently so. Moral expertise, a problem in the professional ethics of professional ethicists, is the title of one article in an ethics journal. As I said, the signs of erosion are everywhere. What to do? Suppose that rather than invoking the Ten Commandments, we got into the habit of signing our name to some secular statement, similar to a professional oath, that would remind us of our commitment to honesty. Would a simple oath make a difference, in the way that we saw the Ten Commandments make a difference? We needed to find out. Hence our next experiment. Once again, we assembled our participants. In this study, the first group of participants took our matrix math test and handed in their answers to the experimenter in the front of the room, who counted how many questions they answered correctly and paid them accordingly. The second group also took the test, but the members of this group were told to fold their answer sheet, keep it in their possession, and tell the experimenter in the front of the room how many of the problems they got right. The experimenter paid them accordingly, and they were on their way. The novel aspect of this experiment had to do with the third group. Before these participants began, each was asked to sign the following statement on the answer sheet. I understand that this study falls under the MIT honor system. After signing this statement, they continued with the task. When the time had elapsed, they pocketed their answer sheets, walked to the front of the room, told the experimenter how many problems they had correctly solved, and were paid accordingly. What were the results? In the control condition, in which cheating was not possible, participants solved, on average, 3 problems. In the second condition, in which the participants could pocket their answers, they claimed to have solved, on average, 5.5 problems. What was remarkable was the third situation, in which the participants pocketed their answer sheets, but had also signed the honor code statement. In this case, they claimed to have solved, on average, 3 problems, exactly the same number as the control group. This outcome was similar to the results we achieved with the Ten Commandments, where a moral reminder eliminated cheating altogether. The effect of signing a statement about an honor code is particularly amazing when we take into account that MIT doesn't even have an honor code. So we learned that people cheat when they have a chance to do so, but they don't cheat as much as they could. Moreover, once they begin thinking about honesty, whether by recalling the Ten Commandments or by signing a simple statement, they stop cheating completely. In other words, when we are removed from any benchmarks of ethical thought, we tend to stray into dishonesty. But if we are reminded of morality at the moment we are tempted, then we are much more likely to be honest. At present, several state bars and professional organizations are scrambling to shore up their professional ethics. Some are increasing courses in college and graduate schools, and others are requiring brush-up ethics classes. In the legal profession, Judge Dennis M. Sweeney of the Howard County, Maryland Circuit, published his own book, Guidelines for Lawyer Courtroom Conduct, in which he noted, "Most rules, like these, are simply what our mothers would say a polite and well-raised man or woman should do, since, given their other important responsibilities, our mothers and yours cannot be in every courtroom in the state, I offer these rules." Will such general measures work? Let's remember that lawyers do take an oath when they are admitted to the bar, as doctors take an oath when they enter their profession. But occasional swearing of oaths and occasional statements of adherence to rules are not enough. From our experiments, it is clear that oaths and rules must be recalled at, or just before, the moment of temptation. Also, what is more, time is working against us as we try to curb this problem. As I said in Chapter 4, that when social norms collide with market norms, the social norms go away, and the market norms stay. Even if the analogy is not exact, honesty offers a related lesson. Once professional ethics, the social norms, have declined, getting them back won't be easy. This doesn't mean that we shouldn't try. Why is honesty so important? For one thing, let's not forget that the United States holds a position of economic power in the world today, partly because it is, or at least is perceived to be, one of the world's most honest nations in terms of its standards of corporate governance. In 2002, the United States ranked 20th in the world in terms of integrity, according to one survey. Denmark, Finland, and New Zealand were first, and Haiti, Iraq, Myanmar, and Somalia were last, at number 163. On this basis, I would suspect that people doing business with the United States generally feel they can get a fair deal. But the fact of the matter is that the United States ranked 14th in 2000, before the wave of corporate scandals made the business pages in American newspapers look like a police blotter. We are going down the slippery slope, in other words, not up it, and this can have tremendous long-term costs. Adam Smith reminded us that honesty really is the best policy, especially in business. To get a glimpse of the other side of that realization, at the downside, in a society without trust, you can take a look at several countries. In China, the word of one person in one region rarely carries to another region. Latin America is full of family-run cartels that hand out loans to relatives and then fail to cut off credit when the debtor begins to default. Iran is another example of a nation stricken by distrust. An Iranian student at MIT told me that business there lacks a platform of trust. Because of this, no one pays in advance, no one offers credit, and no one is willing to take risks. People must hire within their families, where some level of trust still exists. Would you like to live in such a world? Be careful, because without honesty, we might get there faster than you'd imagine. What can we do to keep our country honest? We can read the Bible, the Quran, or whatever reflects our values, perhaps. We can revive professional standards. We can sign our names to promises that we will act with integrity. Another path is to first recognize that when we get into situations where our personal financial benefit stands in opposition to our moral standards, we are able to bend reality, see the world in terms compatible with our selfish interest, and become dishonest. What is the answer, then? If we recognize this weakness, we can try to avoid such situations from the outset. We can prohibit physicians from ordering tests that would benefit them financially. We can prohibit accountants and auditors from functioning as consultants to the same companies. We can bar members of Congress from setting their own salaries, and so on. But this is not the end of the issue of dishonesty. In the next chapter, I will offer some other suggestions about dishonesty and some other insights into how we struggle with it. Appendix Chapter 11. The Ten Commandments. I am the Lord your God. You shall have no other gods before me. You shall not take the name of the Lord your God in vain. Keep holy the Sabbath day. Honor your father and your mother. You shall not kill. You shall not commit adultery. You shall not steal. You shall not bear false witness. You shall not covet your neighbor's wife. You shall not covet your neighbor's goods. Chapter 12. The Context of Our Character, Part 2. Why Dealing with Cash Makes Us More Honest. Many of the dormitories at MIT have common areas, where sit a variety of refrigerators that can be used by the students in the nearby rooms. One morning at about 11, when most of the students were in class, I slipped into the dorms and floor by floor went hunting for all the shared refrigerators that I could find. When I detected a communal fridge, I inched toward it. Glancing cautiously around, I opened the door, slipped in a six-pack of Coke, and walked briskly away. At a safe distance, I paused and jotted down the time and the location of the fridge where I had left my Cokes. Over the next few days, I returned to check on my Coke cans. I kept a diary detailing how many of them remained in the fridge. As you might expect, the half-life of Coke in a college dorm isn't very long. All of them had vanished within 72 hours. But I didn't always leave Cokes behind. In some of the fridges, I left a plate containing 6 $1 bills. Would the money disappear faster than the Cokes? Before I answer that question, let me ask you one. Suppose your spouse calls you at work. Your daughter needs a red pencil for school the next day. Could you bring one home? How comfortable would you be taking a red pencil from work for your daughter? Very uncomfortable? Somewhat uncomfortable? Completely comfortable? Let me ask you another question. Suppose there are no red pencils at work, but you can buy one downstairs for a dime, and the petty cash box in your office has been left open, and no one is around. Would you take 10 cents from the petty cash box to buy the red pencil? Suppose you didn't have any change and needed the 10 cents. Would you feel comfortable taking it? Would that be okay? I don't know about you, but while I'd find taking a red pencil from work relatively easy, I'd have a very hard time taking the cash. Luckily for me, I haven't had to face this issue, since my daughter is not in school yet. As it turns out, the students at MIT also felt differently about taking cash. As I mentioned, the cans of Coke quickly disappeared within 72 hours. Every one of them was gone. But what a different story with the money. The plates of dollar bills remained untouched for 72 hours, until I removed them from the refrigerators. So what's going on here? When we look at the world around us, much of the dishonesty we see involves cheating that is one step removed from cash. Companies cheat with their accounting practices. Executives cheat by using backdated stock options. Lobbyists cheat by underwriting parties for politicians. Drug companies cheat by sending doctors and their wives off on posh vacations. To be sure, these people don't cheat with cold cash, except occasionally. And that's my point. Cheating is a lot easier when it's a step removed from money. Do you think that the architects of Enron's collapse, Kenneth Lay, Jeffrey Skilling, and Andrew Fastow, would have stolen money from the purses of old women? Certainly they took millions of dollars in pension monies from a lot of old women. But do you think they would have hit a woman with a blackjack and pulled the cash from her fingers? You may disagree, but my inclination is to say no. So what permits us to cheat when cheating involves non-monetary objects, and what restrains us when we are dealing with money? How does that irrational impulse work? Because we are so adept at rationalizing our petty dishonesty, it's often hard to get a clear picture of how non-monetary objects influence our cheating. In taking a pencil, for example, we might reason that office supplies are part of our overall compensation, or that lifting a pencil or two is what everyone does. We might say that taking a can of Coke from a communal refrigerator from time to time is all right, because, after all, we've all had cans of Coke taken from us. Maybe Lay, Skilling and Fastow thought that cooking the books at Enron was okay, since it was a temporary measure that could be corrected when business improved. Who knows? To get at the true nature of dishonesty, then, we needed to develop a clever experiment, one in which the object in question would allow few excuses. Nina, On, and I thought about it. Suppose we used a symbolic currency, such as tokens. They were not cash, but neither were they objects with a history, like a Coke or a pencil. Would it give us insight into the cheating process? We weren't sure, but it seemed reasonable. And so, a few years ago, we gave it a try. This is what happened. As the students at one of the MIT cafeterias finished their lunches, we interrupted them to ask whether they would like to participate in a 5-minute experiment. All they had to do, we explained, was solve 20 simple math problems, finding two numbers that added up to 10, and for this they would get 50 cents per correct answer. The experiment began similarly in each case, but ended in one of three different ways. When the participants in the first group finished their tests, they took their worksheets up to the experimenter, who tallied their correct answers and paid them 50 cents for each. The participants in the second group were told to tear up their worksheets, stuff the scraps into their pockets or backpacks, and simply tell the experimenter their score in exchange for payment. So far, this experiment was similar to the tests of honesty described in Chapter 11. But the participants in the last group had something significantly different in their instructions. We told them, as we had told the previous group, to tear up the worksheets and simply tell the experimenter how many questions they had answered correctly. But this time, the experimenter wouldn't be giving them cash. Rather, she would give them a token for each question they claimed to have solved. The students would then walk 12 feet across the room to another experimenter who would exchange each token for 50 cents. Do you see what we were doing? Would the insertion of a token into the transaction, a piece of valueless, non-monetary currency, affect the student's honesty? Would the token make the students less honest in tallying their answers than the students who received cash immediately? If so, by how much? Even we were surprised by the results. The participants in the first group, who had no way to cheat, solved an average of 3.5 questions correctly. They were our control group. The participants in the second group, who tore up their worksheets, claimed to have correctly solved an average of 6.2 questions. Since we can assume that these students did not become smarter merely by tearing up their worksheets, we can attribute the 2.7 additional questions they claimed to have solved to cheating. But in terms of brazen dishonesty, the participants in the third group took the cake. They were no smarter than the previous two groups, but they claimed to have solved an average of 9.4 problems, 5.9 more than the control group, and 3.2 more than the group that merely ripped up the worksheets. This means that when given a chance to cheat under ordinary circumstances, the students cheated, on average, by 2.7 questions. But when they were given the same chance to cheat with non-monetary currency, their cheating increased to 5.9, more than doubling in magnitude. What a difference there is in cheating for money versus cheating for something that is a step away from cash. If that surprises you, consider this. Of the 2,000 participants in our studies of honesty, described in Chapter 11, only 4 ever claimed to have solved all the problems. In other words, the rate of total cheating was 4 in 2,000. Theoretically, it is possible that some people solved all the problems, But since no one in the control conditions solved more than 10 problems, the likelihood that 4 of our participants truly solved 20 is very, very low. For this reason, we assume that they cheated. But in the experiment in which we inserted non-monetary currency, the token, 24 of the study's 450 participants cheated all the way. How many of these 24 extreme cheaters were in the condition with money versus the condition with tokens? They were all in the token condition. 24 of 150 students cheated all the way in this condition. This is equivalent to about 320 per 2,000 participants. This means that not only did the tokens release people from some of their moral constraints, but for quite a few of them, the extent of the release was so complete that they cheated as much as was possible. This level of cheating is clearly bad, but it could have been worse. Let's not forget that the tokens in our experiments were transformed into cash within a matter of seconds. What would the rate of dishonesty have been if the transfer from a non-monetary token to cash took a few days, weeks, or months, as for instance in a stock option? Would even more people cheat, and to a larger extent? We have learned that given a chance, people cheat. But what's really odd is that most of us don't see this coming. When we asked students in another experiment to predict if people would cheat more for tokens than for cash, the students said no, the amount of cheating would be the same. After all, they explained, the tokens represented real money, and the tokens were exchanged within seconds for actual cash, and so, they predicted, our participants would treat the tokens as real cash. But how wrong they were. They didn't see how fast we can rationalize our dishonesty when it is one step away from cash. Of course, their blindness is ours as well. Perhaps it's why so much cheating goes on. Perhaps it's why Jeff Skilling, Bernie Ebbers, and the entire roster of executives who have been prosecuted in recent years let themselves and their companies slide down the slope. All of us are vulnerable to this weakness, of course. Think about all the insurance fraud that goes on. It is estimated that when consumers report losses on their homes and cars, they creatively stretch their claims by about 10%. Of course, as soon as you report an exaggerated loss, the insurance company raises its rates, so the situation becomes tit for tat. Again, it is not the case that there are many claims that are completely flagrant. But instead, many people who have lost, say, a 27-inch television set, report the loss of a 32-inch set. Those who have lost a 32-inch set report the loss of a 36-inch set, and so on. These same people would be unlikely to steal money directly from the insurance companies, as tempting as that might sometimes be, but reporting what they no longer have, and increasing its size and value by just a little bit, makes the moral burden easier to bear. There are other interesting practices. Have you ever heard the term wardrobing? Wardrobing is buying an item of clothing, wearing it for a while, and then returning it in such a state that the store has to accept it, but can no longer resell it. By engaging in wardrobing, consumers are not directly stealing money from the company. Instead, it is a dance of buying and returning, with many unclear transactions involved. But there is at least one clear consequence. The clothing industry estimates that its annual losses from wardrobing are about $16 billion, about the same amount as the estimated annual loss from home burglaries and automobile theft combined. And how about expense reports? When people are on business trips, they are expected to know what the rules are, but expense reports, too, are one step, and sometimes even a few steps, removed from cash. In one study, Nina and I found that not all expenses are alike in terms of people's ability to justify them as business expenses. For example, buying a mug for $5 for an attractive stranger was clearly out of bounds, but buying the same stranger an $8 drink in a bar was very easy to justify. The difference was not the cost of the item or the fear of getting caught, but people's ability to justify the item to themselves as a legitimate use of their expense account. A few more investigations into expense accounts turned up similar rationalizations. In one study, we found that when people give receipts to their administrative assistants to submit, they are then one additional step removed from the dishonest act, and hence more likely to slip in questionable receipts. In another study, we found that business people who live in New York are more likely to consider a gift for their kid as a business expense if they purchased it at the San Francisco airport or someplace else far from home than if they had purchased it at the New York airport or on their way home from the airport. None of this makes logical sense, but when the medium of exchange is non-monetary, our ability to rationalize increases by leaps and bounds. I had my own experience with dishonesty a few years ago. Someone broke into my Skype account, very cool online telephone software, and charged my PayPal account, an online payment system, a few $100 for the service. I don't think the person who did this was a hardened criminal. From a criminal's perspective, breaking into my account would most likely be a waste of time and talent, because if this person was sufficiently smart to hack into Skype, he could probably have hacked into Amazon, Dell, or maybe even a credit card account, and got much more value for his time. Rather, I imagine that this person was a smart kid who had managed to hack into my account and who took advantage of this free communication by calling anyone who would talk to him until I managed to regain control of my account. He may have even seen this as a techie challenge. Or maybe he is a student whom I once gave a bad grade and who decided to tweak my nose for it. Would this kid have taken cash from my wallet, even if he knew for sure that no one would ever catch him? Maybe. But I imagine that the answer is no. Instead, I suspect that there were some aspects of Skype, and of how my account was set up, that helped this person engage in this activity, and not feel morally reprehensible. First, he stole calling time, not money. Next, he did not gain anything tangible from the transaction. Third, he stole from Skype, rather than directly from me. Fourth, he might have imagined that at the end of the day, Skype, not I, would cover the cost. Fifth, the cost of the calls was charged automatically to me via PayPal. So here we had another step in the process, and another level of fuzziness in terms of who would eventually pay for the calls. Just in case you are wondering, I have since cancelled this direct link to PayPal. Was this person stealing from me? Sure. But there were so many things that made the theft fuzzy. I really don't think he thought of himself as a dishonest guy. No cash was taken, right? And was anyone really hurt? This kind of thinking is worrisome. If my problem with Skype was indeed due to the non-monetary nature of the transactions on Skype, this would mean that there is much more at risk here, including a wide range of online services, and perhaps even credit and debit cards. All these electronic transactions, with no physical exchange of money from hand to hand, might make it easier for people to be dishonest, without ever questioning or fully acknowledging the immorality of their actions. There's another sinister impression that I took out of our studies. In our experiments, the participants were smart, caring, honorable individuals, who for the most part had a clear limit to the amount of cheating they would undertake, even with non-monetary currency like the tokens. For almost all of them, there was a point at which their conscience called for them to stop, and they did. Accordingly, the dishonesty that we saw in our experiments was probably the lower boundary of human dishonesty. The level of dishonesty practiced by individuals who want to be ethical and who want to see themselves as ethical, the so-called good people. The scary thought is that if we did the experiments with non-monetary currencies that were not as immediately convertible into money as tokens, or with individuals who cared less about their honesty, or with behavior that was not so publicly observable, we would most likely have found even higher levels of dishonesty. In other words, the level of deception we observed here is probably an underestimation of the level of deception we would find across a variety of circumstances and individuals. Now suppose that you have a company, or a division of a company, led by a Gordon Gekko character, who declares that greed is good. And suppose he used non-monetary means of encouraging dishonesty. Can you see how such a swashbuckler could change the mindset of people who in principle want to be honest, and want to see themselves as honest, but also want to hold on to their jobs and get ahead in the world? It is under just such circumstances that non-monetary currencies can lead us astray. They let us bypass our conscience and freely explore the benefits of dishonesty. This view of human nature is worrisome. We can hope to surround ourselves with good moral people, but we have to be realistic. Even good people are not immune to being partially blinded by their own minds. This blindness allows them to take actions that bypass their own moral standards on the road to financial rewards. In essence, motivation can play tricks on us whether or not we are good, moral people. As the author and journalist Upton Sinclair once noted, it is difficult to get a man to understand something when his salary depends upon his not understanding it. We can now add the following thought. It is even more difficult to get a man to understand something when he is dealing with non-monetary currencies. The problems of dishonesty, by the way, don't apply just to individuals. In recent years, we have seen business in general succumb to a lower standard of honesty. I'm not talking about big acts of dishonesty like those perpetrated by Enron and WorldCom. I mean the small acts of dishonesty that are similar to swiping Cokes out of the refrigerator. There are companies out there, in other words, that aren't stealing cash off our plates, so to speak, but are stealing things one step removed from cash. There are plenty of examples. Recently, one of my friends, who had carefully saved up his frequent flyer miles for a vacation, went to the airline who issued all these miles. He was told that all the dates he wanted were blacked out. In other words, although he had saved up 25,000 frequent flyer miles, he couldn't use them, and he tried many dates. But, the representative said, if he wanted to use 50,000 miles, there might be some seats. She checked. Sure, there were seats everywhere. To be sure, there was probably some small print in the frequent flyer brochure explaining that this was okay. But to my friend, the 25,000 miles he had earned represented a lot of money. Let's say it was $450. Would this airline have mugged him for that amount of cash? Would the airline have swiped it from his bank account? No. But because it was one step removed, the airline stole it from him in the form of requiring 25,000 additional miles. For another example, look at what banks are doing with credit card rates. Consider what is called two-cycle billing. There are several variations of this trick, but the basic idea is that the moment you don't pay your bill in full, the credit issuer will not only charge a high interest rate on new purchases, but will actually reach into the past and charge interest on past purchases as well. When the Senate Banking Committee looked into this recently, it heard plenty of testimony that certainly made the banks look dishonest. For instance, a man in Ohio who charged $3,200 to his card soon found his debt to be $10,700 because of penalties, fees, and interest. These were not boiler room operators charging high interest rates and fees, but some of the biggest and presumably most reputable banks in America. Those whose advertising campaigns would make you believe that you and the bank were family. Would a family member steal your wallet? No. But these banks, with a transaction somewhat removed from cash, apparently would. Once you view dishonesty through this lens, it is clear that you can't open a newspaper in the morning without seeing new examples to add. And so we return to our original observation. Isn't cash strange? When we deal with money, we are primed to think about our actions as if we had just signed an honor code. If you look at a dollar bill, in fact, it seems to have been designed to conjure up a contract. The United States of America, it says, in prominent type, with a shadow beneath that makes it seem three-dimensional. And there is George Washington himself, and we all know that he could never tell a lie. And then, on the back, it gets even more serious. In God we trust, it says. And then we've got that weird pyramid, and on top that unblinking eye, and it's looking right at us. In addition to all this symbolism, the sanctity of money could also be aided by the fact that money is a clear unit of exchange. It's hard to say that a dime is not a dime, or a buck isn't a buck. But look at the latitude we have with non-monetary exchanges. There's always a convenient rationale. We can take a pencil from work, a Coke from the fridge, we can even backdate our stock options, and find a story to explain it all. We can be dishonest without thinking of ourselves as dishonest. We can steal while our conscience is apparently fast asleep. How can we fix this? We could label each item in the supply cabinet with a price, for instance. Or use wording that explains stocks and stock options clearly in terms of their monetary value. But in the larger context, we need to wake up to the connection between non-monetary currency and our tendency to cheat. We need to recognize that once cash is a step away, we will cheat by a factor bigger than we could ever imagine. We need to wake up to this, individually and as a nation, and do it soon. Why? For one thing, the days of cash are coming to a close. Cash is a drag on the profits of banks. They want to get rid of it. On the other hand, electronic instruments are very profitable. Profits from credit cards in the United States rose from $9 billion in 1996 to a record $27 billion in 2004. By 2010, banking analysts say, there will be $50 billion in new electronic transactions, nearly twice the number processed under the Visa and MasterCard brands in 2004. The question, therefore, is how we can control our tendency to cheat when we are brought to our senses only by the sight of cash, and what we can do now that cash is going away. Willie Sutton allegedly said that he robbed banks because that's where the money was. By that logic, he might be writing the fine print for a credit card company today, or penciling in blackout dates for an airline. It might not be where the cash is, but it's certainly where you will find the money. Chapter 13. Beer and Free Lunches. What is behavioral economics, and where are the free lunches? The Carolina Brewery is a hip bar on Franklin Street, the main street outside the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. A beautiful street with brick buildings and old trees, it has many restaurants, bars, and coffee shops. More than one would expect to find in a small town. As you open the doors to the Carolina Brewery, you see an old building with high ceilings and exposed beams, and a few large stainless steel beer containers that promise a good time. There are semi-private tables scattered around. This is a favorite place for students, as well as an older crowd, to enjoy good beer and food. Soon after I joined MIT, Jonathan Levov, a professor at Columbia, and I were mulling over the kinds of questions one might conjure up in such a pleasant pub. First, does the sequential process of taking orders, asking each person in turn to state his or her order, influence the choices that the people sitting around the table ultimately make? In other words, are the patrons influenced by the selections of the others around them? Second, if this is the case, does it encourage conformity or nonconformity? In other words, would the patrons sitting around a table intentionally choose beers that were different from or the same as the choices of those ordering before them? Finally, we wanted to know whether being influenced by others' choices would make people better or worse off, in terms of how much they enjoyed their beer. Throughout this book, I have described experiments that I hoped would be surprising and illuminating. If they were, it was largely because they refuted the common assumption that we are all fundamentally rational. Time and again, I have provided examples that are contrary to Shakespeare's depiction of us in What a Piece of Work is Man. In fact, these examples show that we are not noble in reason, not infinite in faculty, and rather weak in apprehension. Frankly, I think Shakespeare knew that very well, and this speech of Hamlet's is not without irony. In this final chapter, I will present an experiment that offers one more example of our predictable irrationality. Then I will further describe the general economic perspective on human behavior, contrast it with behavioral economics, and draw some conclusions. Let me begin with the experiment. To get to the bottom of the sudsy barrel of questions that we thought of at the Carolina Brewery, Jonathan and I decided to plunge in, metaphorically, of course. We started by asking the manager of the Carolina Brewery to let us serve free samples of beer to the customers, as long as we paid for the beer ourselves. Imagine how difficult it was later to convince the MIT accountants that a $1,400 bill for beer is a legitimate research expense. The manager of the bar was happy to comply. After all, he would sell us the beer, and his customers would receive a free sample, which would presumably increase their desire to return to the brewery. Handing us our aprons, he established his one and only condition: that we approach the people and get their orders for samples within 1 minute of the time they set.